Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A three-judge federal court in Cincinnati has ruled that the Ohio congressional map is unconstitutionally gerrymandered and must be redrawn before Election Day in 2020. The unanimous decision found that Republican mapmakers manipulated district lines to control outcomes in favor of GOP candidates. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome back.
Hi, good morning.
And Ohio Public Radio State House news reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back.
Awesome to be here.
Now, some have referred to it as throwing the state of politics into chaos. I think that's a little drastic, but...
It could be if it actually stands.
If it stands, what's the timeline here?
Well, the judge, what the court ruling says is that by June 14th, lawmakers have to go back and draw a constitutional map. Basically, the judge panel said the problem with this map is that it's gerrymandering, that it denies constitutional. It doesn't meet constitutional muster. OK. And that it really needs to be completely withdrawn. So they're saying, go back, lawmakers, do this by June 14th. And if you don't, we're going to appoint a special master to come in and do it.
Master sounds like a blue ribbon commission / state takeover / what?
It's called how the court wants to get stuff done. That's what it is. So anyway, they want it in place for next year's election. That's the thing. But it's probably going to get a stay because Dave Yost, the attorney general of Ohio, is asking for a stay. And the odds are probably pretty good because there are some other cases out there that are similar. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, is looking at these cases and they could rule. I don't know, fairly quickly.
Right.
So
Maryland and North Carolina are on
right.
Michigan right
is,
now, and Michigan as well.
Right.
What distinguishes or compare and contrast Ohio's case with the others? Are they all the same? Is this just a trend, Jeremy?
It's a trend. It started with Pennsylvania when a court out there redrew all the districts out there, and they redrew them in a way that favored Democrats. Of course, if the Ohio ruling holds, it'll also favor Democrats because Republicans drew the district lines.
Why does it have to favor one party over the other? Is that a, I mean...
When I say favor, I mean it'll be better
Democrats.
Not that it'll
yeah.
be absolutely in favor right. of Democrats.
Oh, sure. Laura? I was just going to say, I mean, this is gerrymandering is happening in all kinds of, all sorts of states, and... you know, it's something that's being challenged, and I agree with Joe. I think that they're probably the Attorney General's office is going to seek a stay, may get that. I know that the Democrats are really, kind of dancing a jig over this right now, but I don't know that it's going to hold.
Well, and the thing is, can you imagine this? If they're, lawmakers right now are trying to get this 2-year budget together. Can you imagine if on top of it, they're trying to draw a congressional
yeah,
map?
Yeah, but everybody knows that you could have a computer do it.
Well, and
it's not that big of a deal.
Well, it depends what you want a computer to do.
That's right.
I feel like they make it sound as though it's something like they're really tortured over this, but what they're really doing is behind the scenes making Rice Krispie treats and just making it look like it's really hard to do.
And then
that they can come out from in the kitchen and it's
right.
it's like, oh my gosh, you have no idea how much I struggled over this.
Right. Right.
Well, the thing is, it's not just about party; it's about incumbents.
Yeah.
This is a lot of district lines are drawn to favor incumbents because
right.
If you're a congressperson. You have a say in where your lines are. And I can't imagine that most incumbents are very happy about this ruling, even if they're Democrats. I can't imagine Joyce Beatty is
because
very happy
Democratic,
about
Democratic districts are as safe as the Republicans one, even though there's so many fewer.
Correct.
So many fewer.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that computer, the essence of the computers being able to go in and draw the lines, that's kind of why this case was brought so late. It was brought in 2018. Those maps, they started developing them in 2011, the legislative and congressional map, the this only affects the congressional, by the way. But they started drawing it in 2011. In 2012, it was actually passed, put in place. And they waited till 2018. The ACLU waited until 2018. There's others involved, too, Legal Women Voters and others. And they filed in 2018. Now we have this ruling. The reason they waited all that time, though, was that the courts are starting to look at these new methodologies that are being used for drawing maps and, you know, considering that. And you could actually go in if you wanted to and put in, you know, how you want the map to look and who you want it to favor. And these things could draw it that way.
Yeah, the 300-page ruling from the court talked about, like, this software called Maptitude and how, you know, some staffers, some Republican staffers holed up in a hotel room and, you know, kept monkeying around with it and responding to requests and input from kind of the heavy hitters like John Boehner and the legislative leadership. I think Keith Faber was involved in it as well.
And some party leadership out of Washington.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And I think also Jeremy's right. Like, the Democrats who have safe districts, they're
it's always been a problem.
Yeah, they're pretty happy with it.
It's always been a problem. Since the map came into effect in 2012, Ohio's congressional delegation has been locked in at 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats.
It's the first time since the 1970s that there's been no change. There's a whole map plan with no change in party.
In party at all. And really, I guess the court's asking ultimately, do 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats truly represent the state of Ohio?
Well, percentage-wise, no. Last election, 56% of Ohioans voted Republican, but 75% of Ohio is represented by a Republican. So if you just look at the straight numbers. But the thing is, it's not just about population. It's really hard to draw these maps because, yeah, you can draw all the lines just based on population, but you have to do it based on race. You know, should you draw a district that is majority-minority? You have to do it on demographics. Should they be drawn to make competitive districts or not? Continue by county lines, you know, do you have to make draw? There's all these different factors. So it's not just a matter of drawing the lines and making population the same. It's different than that. It's more complicated.
This one has some real questionable things on it. From the get-go, it was questionable because this congressional map has the what's been called the mistake on the lake, where basically they take Marcy Kaptur's district and it goes over like all the way from like near Cleveland all the way to near Toledo. And it just has this weird line at the top.
I think it's connected by a bridge.
It is. It's connected by a bridge. It's a bizarre district. It's not something that you would ever try to draw.
There's a member of Congress who represents everything down to Brown County up into Upper Arlington. And in the world Brown County and Upper Arlington have in common is.
Right.
So there's got to be a logical coalescence of there's got to be a commonality about the
and I think that that's the goal of the new process that was voter approved is to have to not divide counties as much and to have a more like you said, logical.
How many ways is Franklin County divided? Is it
at least three?
Joyce Beatty's district is most of it. Steve Stivers, like you were saying, the Upper Arlington is part of it. And then there's 12, Balderson, and he has a bunch of the
northern Franklin County.
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean I think that the Republicans though say that like this. This map has been in place for nearly a decade and that this lawsuit came right after this new process was approved by the voters and that it's very part of the fact that there's a legal challenge to it is very partisan and kind of late in the game.
But it's not the Democratic Party. It's Legal Women Voters.
A Philip Randolph, ACLU. Mm-hmm.
The ballot issue overwhelmingly passed last May. Voters are more aware of this issue than ever before.
They are.
And it placed new requirements on Ohio's map drawing process.
Right.
But it wouldn't be this new map that came out of that wouldn't be created until after the 2020 census, which means that it wouldn't come into effect until 2022.
Right.
So that's the next midterm election.
Sure. So that's another 3 years in which we will have a hyper-partisan map.
And 2020 is kind of considered an important year.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of congressional races.
A lot of stuff going on.
The three-judge panel, I think it was one Republican, Michael Watson, and two Democrats.
Two Democrats.
It was unanimous, though.
It was.
Right.
But it was a three-judge panel, and two were Democrats. And Laura's right that the third, Judge Watson, is a Republican, or appointed by George W. Bush, at least. Right.
I don't know. I know you guys don't cover the U.S. Supreme Court, but what do we know about where how the court deals with the gerrymandering issues? It has a history of sidestepping them, does it not?
Yeah, and I think that there's a concern that if the Supreme Court rules on it, then it applies across the nation.
Right.
So maybe they're waiting for the right case. Maybe they're letting states decide. Like you said, I don't cover the Supreme Court. So.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We've got a new Supreme Court, too. I mean, you've got to realize that, new members on there who are Republican, who are conservative. And, will that make a difference? I don't know. But like you said, this in other states, where our map is drawn to benefit Republicans, in other states, it's drawn to benefit Democrats. So who knows how they'll uphold.
Well, keep in mind that in the Pennsylvania case, they did let that go through. So, if you have some precedent, the Pennsylvania redistricting case was let through by the Supreme Court. So, I'm not saying that's necessarily predictive of what's going to happen here, but the only time it has gone through, they redrawn all the districts in Pennsylvania.
So if they rule on Maryland, North Carolina, or Michigan, Michigan's before the U.S. Supreme Court as well, you said, Jeremy?
It was just decided pretty recently, so I think it's headed there. I'm not 100% sure, but it's headed there.
Is there anything Ohio can get from those? You're saying that it'll just apply whatever they rule on, when they rule on it, applies to everything.
They might just merge all the cases into mm-hmm. one.
That's probably where they'll go. But, you can't second guess the court. You never know what they're going to do.
Right. It's kind of new.
It's its own little.
It will come pretty soon, though. Like, I can't imagine they're not going to wait till next year to decide, because the filing deadline is in December for Ohio for congressional candidates.
Right. I think the decision will come soon.
Okay, we will take a break. This is our weekly reporter roundtable that Jeremy Pelzer, Cleveland.com politics reporter, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau are all with us. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and Ohio Public Radio State House News reporter Joe Ingles. Laura, you wrote about how Governor DeWine is working to change how the Ohio Parole Board operates. What sort of reforms is he looking at?
Well, this came on the heels of former parole board member Shirley Smith, a Democrat from Cleveland. She resigned December 31st and issued a really blistering public rebuke of how the system works. She says it's toxic, it's secretive, that they don't really follow rational rules, and that there's not enough diversity of thought on the parole board. They're allowed to have up to 12 members. They're appointed by the prison director. It's a full-time job, pays like 80 high 80s to low hundreds. After she issued her rebuke, I thought, well, I want to find out more details about what's going on with that board. And I interviewed lots of different prisoners. I got a stack of prisoner mail just hundreds of letters. I spoke with crime victims, how they've interacted with the parole board and what they're upset about, defense attorneys, lawmakers, et cetera. And I think, you know, we wrote a story that ran April 7th on kind of all the issues of transparency and communication and all the rest of it. And Mike DeWine, you know, read that and also read Smith's criticisms. And he announced three new appointees with more varied backgrounds. He announced that they're working toward maybe live streaming the full board hearings, and allowing inmates to participate via video conference in those hearings, allowing crime victims to have access to the inmates' institutional summaries of how their behavior's gone. He said he's working with lawmakers for more legislative changes, and then also he wants more guidelines issued by DRC to the parole board about how to weigh misconduct tickets that inmates get when they, you know, they're in prison. They can get written up for minor things like, you know, having a piece of fruit that they took from the chow hall.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was talking to this one guy, Bernard Keith, who's been in prison a long time, and he sued the parole board in 2014 representing himself, and he's been denied parole since then. And one of the reasons why they denied him was he had a misconduct ticket for having too much commissary. Like he had too many
Twinkies?
Too many Little Debbies, he told me.
Little Debbies, okay.
And that was weighed against him. And so the governor said that he'd like to see, you know, the kind of the gravity of the misconduct, that having too many bags of Doritos should not be considered have the same weight as assaulting a staff member.
How does the parole board defend itself against these criticisms?
Well, I mean, it says that, you know, all of its policies and procedures are publicly available, and that they are bound by certain state laws that, you know, mandate confidentiality and mandate that they consider, you know, how many times somebody's had a successful or unsuccessful parole in the past, or how many. They also say that misconduct in prison is indicative of how you're going to behave once you are released. Mm. That, you know, research shows that. And so, but, you know, the crime victims, lawyers, lawmakers, prison advocates, et cetera, they're very frustrated with the lack of transparency. I was kind of surprised the last full board hearing that I covered, they didn't even print an agenda. This is a public body.
So you don't know who's getting up next?
No. You have to, like, I'm like, okay, so which inmates are coming up? Oh, well, we have a list. I'm like, okay, well, why isn't that available to the public?
And they're saying it's not a public record?
No, they had to, like, go print it. But I'm thinking, you know,
right,
why not run it like every other public body where, you know, there's a printed agenda, there are minutes available that you can. They also have another weird part of state law, and this is something that the governor does not want to change, but allows crime victims to make a witness statement before the full board, but exclude the media from that portion of the meeting. So they're still going to be allowed to, like, shut down the meeting for a portion.
I guess that's kind of an idea of not re-victimizing.
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what Shirley Smith, she laid out a whole litany of, she claimed that a lot of times that parole board members weren't paying attention during hearings because they were eating, because they deal with
Speaking
so many cases.
Doritos, yeah.
They have to do meetings during lunch. She claimed that
I was going to say, that's not during the full board meetings.
Correct. I'm sorry.
But, you know, when an inmate is up for parole, he or she will go by video conference and with a subset of the parole
board.
And that's when Shirley Smith was saying that they weren't really paying attention. They weren't dialed in full attention on it.
She was also saying that the parole board needs to be more diverse because it's made up mostly of white former parole officers. And, of course, she says that the majority of inmates in Ohio are people of color. So one of the three new ones, new parole board members, is Glenn Holmes, who's a Democrat. He's an African American, but
I don't know that Shirley's criticism, though, was so much about race, so much as diversity of thought.
Well, I talked to her, so that's what she was saying.
That most, so, but there are African Americans on the parole board. It's a matter of, like, that they all come up through the prosecution and through the prison side of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the recent appointees, I'm sorry, the name is escaping me, is a public defender.
Correct.
So
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, racial and professional diversity. So even what, and Shirley Smith, when I talked to her after these new round of reforms came out, she was like, you know, it's really good they're trying to deal with this, but still, I want to see I want to see more diversity. You know, I want to see a board that's majority people of color, minorities.
That reflects
the population that they are dealing with. And also, Governor DeWine, there's one more open parole board seat that he hasn't filled yet. Uh-huh. And he wants to fill that with a mental health professional, which is something that Shirley Smith also called for.
The director of Ohio Justice and Policy Center, David Singleton, said the reforms are a good first step. How has the parole board responded to this? What is their?
Well, it's hard to contact him because they're, for obvious reasons, their names are not in the phone book. So I don't know about Laura, but most of the dealings I've had
with
them.
They have an office though, right?
They have an office, but then you have to deal with their press person and stuff goes through them. So they have not been made available to me.
I think the response that we're seeing is through the governor. I think that the DRC director, Annette Chambers Smith, when I interviewed her for the story, you know, she said that she had spoken with Shirley Smith and had spoken to all the parole board members and had talked to inmates, and that she was forming this, you know, to make some changes and to make it more transparent and to make it more responsive. And I think that the response we're getting from the parole board is through Annette Chambers Smith and the DeWine administration saying, this is how we're going to run it.
And DeWine said that this is only the beginning. You know, there's going to be more reforms coming. This is just the first round of them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. So the parole board is under the auspices of DRC?
Mm-hmm. Correct. And gotcha. The DRC director is the one who makes the appointments, obviously, with
the— technically through the governor's—
well, like, you know, I'm sure the governor has a big say in it.
Right.
You know, the parole board has jurisdiction over old law.
I was going to bring up the old law, new law.
So they have jurisdiction over about 9,000 inmates out of the 50,000 that are in state prisons. And about half of them are what's called old law. And these are people who were sentenced to indeterminate sentences before Ohio changed its law in 1996.
Kind of like the 5 to 10 years or the 20 to 50 year or whatever.
Yeah, or 25 kind of, to 40 or you know,
there were, life or whatever. Yeah.
Before the truth in sentencing laws.
Right.
Right. And that was Senate Bill 2 in 1996.
So this is a dwindling number then.
Yes, but they also have another chunk of inmates, another 4,000 or so, who were sentenced to, like, you know, 15 to life on a murder charge or— like really very serious violent crimes. And those people are also under the jurisdiction of the parole board.
So what that basically means is it's people who are serving longer sentences, which usually means more severe crimes.
Hey, and this is no easy job either.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
You know, we wrote about the parole board back in like 2012-ish or so. And then shortly after that, they paroled a guy named Damian Wesley back to Dayton. He had been turned down multiple times. They thought he was ready to go home. He goes back, and within months, he is accused of sexually assaulting his ex-girlfriend. And then shortly after that, he was accused of shooting his ex-girlfriend's 13-year-old daughter in the head to death and her 13-year-old cousin. And he was arrested and died in custody in the Montgomery County Jail of a heart attack. He was very overweight. But that's the kind of nightmare scenario that I think every parole board member worries about. And I talked to Michael Jackson, who served on the parole board, and he said that, yeah, every time there was some horrific crime in the news, he was constantly like just going to look it up like, oh, my God, is this somebody who we let out, who we should not have let out?
Well, the only alternative, I mean, how do you, that's like trying to play God. I mean, who's
yeah, there is
know?
No, there's no crystal ball.
There's no crystal ball. Has anyone looked into how they do it in other countries? Crazy me. I mean, is
well,
there,
I've looked into other states.
Okay.
Other states, it varies widely. There are some states where the parole board, everything has to be open. Like all the meetings.
Does that change
all the
anything?
Documents. It is. I mean, it's the same. It's still the same problems that Laura is talking about in terms of they have to live with it. But I mean, it's something. So, for example, in California, in Ohio right now, if you're denied parole, you'll get kind of like a blanket one sentence like, you're not ready. And then people are like, well, what does that mean? I don't know what that
means.
Why
aren't you ready?
And
yeah.
then in California, you get access to all the parole board written correspondence. It's all open to the public.
So the parole board is being sued right now by the Ohio Justice Policy Center and the ACLU. Their client is a woman named Rhonda Head, and they're suing over the whole idea that the inmate does not have – it's like a black box to the inmate. They don't know what documents the parole board is relying on to make this decision.
So you get a note saying you're just not ready. Well, what can I do to get ready? They
right.
don't know.
They would like more direction. Yeah. They also allege in this lawsuit that there's a first flop policy. A flop is where they tell you, sorry, we're going to just keep you in prison. And, you know, DRC says there's no such policy. You know, I would say one of the things that I would look for coming, because I've talked to State Senator Peggy Lehner from the Kettering area, and I think John Eklund from Chardon might be interested in this as well, is to do a bill on presumptive parole, which means you're sentenced to 15 to 30. If you do your 15 years, you go up to the parole board, you're like automatically considered like, yeah, you're going to get out unless there's a really good reason to keep you in.
Besides having too many little Debbies.
Yeah, Doritos aren't going to hold you back, but maybe assaulting a staff member would definitely be factored into that. And that's something, presumptive parole is something that David Singleton from the Ohio Justice Policy Center says that, you know, he would like to see happen in Ohio. I think crime victim advocates, probably the Ohio prosecutors, would vehemently oppose that.
All right. Let's move on. The House is proposing a lot of money for a lot of things that is kind of surprising. Education, tax cuts for low-income earners, that pass-through tax cut that was like, say, you know, for the one-person office where, you're tax-free until you make more than $250,000. They want to lower that to $100,000. That's a big one. What's going on with this House, Joe Ingles?
That's huge.
By the way, it's still Republican-controlled.
It is Republican-controlled, but Democrats have had far more say. And
so you think they're having influence?
I think they are having influence. And there's another thing here. The reason that lawmakers back in, 2015? I can't remember when they passed that LLC.
2015.
Was it the $250,000 income earner.
Basically, you can earn up to $250,000 in your LLC and not pay a dime of tax on that first $250,000.
And you could become qualified for low-income benefits.
And they're trying to close that loophole. But basically, the reason that they put that in place is they were hoping that it would actually spur people to go out and, you know, hire some people or somehow.
The trickle-down theory.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And they're not seeing that.
Yeah.
Okay? No, I think it's inspired people to form LLCs.
It has. Yeah. And that's exactly what it is.
Clean up their own trash. Yeah.
What they've done now, what they're saying now is, you know, hey— we need to take care of some of these other problems. You know, this budget has more money for foster kids, for example. It has more money for education. It has more money for aging, you know, for health care for old folks or people with disabilities. It has a lot more money in those kind of places. And it's saying, you know, that's where we need to put our emphasis. And in order to get there, let's look at what's working and what's not. And they don't think that that's working as intended.
There was something that Larry Householder said. I think it was Larry Householder, the speaker, that we need to be doing more for people in Ohio that are
struggling.
Right. Yeah, he said that. Yeah.
And he said, we've done plenty for the rich. Now it's time to do more for the people who are struggling. And it really was interesting.
You know what? I think that the budget will, you know, pass the House and that it's got to go through the Senate. Mm-hmm. And I think the Senate has a very different view than the House does right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at the big struggle that they had over the transportation budget and how much the gas tax should be. There's really, instead of the divide being Democrat and Republican right now, it's more of a Senate-House divide.
But the House upped the ante.
Yes.
Oh, and, the Senate will chip away for more instead of less.
Right.
In the process.
Well, also because, so essentially what the tax plan is in exchange for these state income tax cuts, especially for the lowest income brackets, they are doing the pass-through tax break that Joe talked about, but also they're getting rid of all these different tax expenditures, like right. the motion picture tax credit.
$40 million.
A tax exemption for corporate jets, that kind of stuff. And there's a reason that these tax breaks have stuck around. You know, these things have support within the legislature. And so, especially in the Senate, you're going to, you know, there's going to be a fight to get these things abolished.
There, another phrase that kept popping up in my reading on this was winners and losers. We're not here to pick winners and losers. We're here just to do a fair job and give everybody a fair shake.
Well, let's face it. Every budget is full of winners and losers, you know, but
depends on your definition of fair.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's
the question is, like, with the tax credit for the movie making business, they say that it's more trouble than it's worth. It doesn't generate the revenue. It doesn't generate.
Well, and I think that's data driven. They've looked at the data to see. And I also think the LLC has been, to a point, data driven. You know, they've looked to see how it's been affecting the economy. And you know, the thing is that if you look at these breaks that have been given, you know, they're just really not. In comparison, the benefit of giving those breaks has not been on the other side. We've got these huge needs. We've got the opioid crisis. We've got all these other things that are sucking money away from the state. And there's just no proof that Lisa House is saying there's no proof that these big breaks have helped the situation with Ohio's economy to be able to compensate for these other problems.
But on the other hand, if you're up in Cleveland where they filmed an Avengers movie, you know, your constituents are saying, hey, we want more movies to come to Cleveland. And, you know, look at all the jobs that have been created. So we don't care about your study. Like, give us movies
local,
and jobs.
Local issues, yeah.
Although, you know, there's some thought that those motion pictures, that they really bring workers in from outside the state. It doesn't really grow any jobs locally. You know, this is something, this whole idea that there's all these different tax breaks sprinkled throughout state law. This is something that the Policy Matters Ohio has been really hammering on for years. And, you know, it sounds like maybe they might have some successes in convincing at least the House to get rid of motion picture tax credit or the tax break on owning a share of a private jet. Speaking of rides, they're also talking about taxing Uber and Lyft, ride sharings.
Right.
Again, why shouldn't there be a tax on there, or why should there be a tax? So
we will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Also with us, Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Dayton Daily News government reporter Laura Bischoff, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Okay, there's an energy bill moving through. Republican lawmakers in the House are looking to pull out some of the big changes that were proposed in the energy bill. Where does it stand right now, Joe Ingles? What's going on?
Well, right now they're looking at it and they're trying to figure out behind closed doors, I mean, basically what they want to do with it. They're having some committee hearings on it. They've had some committee hearings on it. It's anyone's guess as to where it's going to go from here. But the way that it stands right now is that, the you know, AE, the AEP and all these others that are not affected by it have kind of sat on the sidelines. And really, it's First Energy versus, you know, everyone else. First Energy Solutions, I should say.
Which is the holding or the company that right. owns the two
owns the two power plants, the two nuclear power plants up
aging
in northern.
Nuclear
yes,
power plants.
Very
and,
aging.
And actually, First Energy Solutions is in bankruptcy and has been for a year
right,
or so.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe it's actually the creditors that own it at
right,
this point.
Right. But they have one plant that they have to do some maintenance. They have to put some money into it, like at the end of the summer.
June, next month.
Yeah. Mm.
They have to decide whether to buy new fuel, new
right.
nuclear fuel.
And so they're kind of looking at this going, well, you know, what do we do here? This new energy bill gives nuclear power. It gives them more money. It gives them credits. It kind of changes everything so that wind and solar don't have as many advantages as they currently do under state law. And whether this will stand, where it will go from here is anyone's real guess.
Basically, what it'll do is it'll scrap the state's energy efficiency and renewable energy standards
right.
and peak demand mandates and replace it with a new surcharge. They'll get rid of those surcharges that you see in your utility bill, and it'll replace it with a new lesser surcharge. And that money will all go to power plants. More than half it'll go to rescue these two nuclear power plants.
The new surcharge, though, it really depends on where you live in Ohio. Mm. In Dayton Power and Light's territory, Dayton, those customers will pay more. The surcharge will be higher than the current surcharges. And
why,
you know,
why?
Because I don't know. I mean, it's like one of those PUCO things.
Okay.
It's like a jumble.
Okay.
But they pay less on average. Like the average statewide for customers is like $4.39. For, again, these three different things blobbed together: energy efficiency, renewable energy standards, and peak demand reduction. But in DPNL's territory, they pay like $1.89 or something. And
mm-hmm.
anyway, the charge would be higher. And I think it is interesting that the way the bill had been written, all the current wind and solar projects wouldn't even qualify for this funding. And the other thing that's interesting is the bill still doesn't address the very restrictive wind setbacks that
mm-hmm.
were put in place. And that has kind of like, you know, kind of strangled a lot of proposed wind turbine
projects.
It's
why you don't see the fields of turbines in Ohio like you do in Indiana.
Correct.
Right.
It's a setback.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain distance away from roads, distance mm-hmm. away from property lines, that kind of a thing.
Now, Democrats in the House are saying that they want that as a condition of their support for this.
They want the setbacks to remain?
They want to change them and yeah. make it, you know, more loose so wind projects can go forward.
You know, there's some really big money behind this. I think Cleveland.com just reported that Generation Now did like a $616,000 TV ad buy across the
state. And I've
heard
radio ads, too, from them.
Right. And that's a dark money group that is trying to get this bill passed, just to, you know, urge Ohioans to tell their lawmakers to vote yes.
Without the changing the setbacks or...
Well, I think they just want that new surcharge,
gotcha.
And
okay.
you know, to help
the
First Energy
power.
Solutions.
It's a
yeah.
pro householder group.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
And householder wants the bill passed.
So the energy bill, is there a timeline for that? I mean, as far as you mentioned, they need to buy new rads for the nuclear power plants, right?
By June.
By June, but is
so
there
a householder
any...
says he wants it done by mid-May.
Huh.
But then it goes to
We're
the Senate.
We're practically there, people.
Practically there. So next week or two.
And then it goes
to the Senate. And then the Senate, it's more of a question mark, although Larry Obhoff, the president, Senate president, has indicated that you know it might not be as tough of a slog through the Senate as people might think.
Okay. What else? The new school funding formula has been shelved.
Mm-hmm.
For now, despite mm-hmm. all the time and effort
Well, it's like every other. I'm sorry. It's like deja vu around the State House. Yeah. I mean, they come up with these blue ribbon panels and all this stuff, and they come out with something, and then the lawmakers say, yeah, we don't like that. And then they pitch it and they do something else. So right now, the House Speaker, Larry Householder, is saying, you know, he thinks that it gives wealthy school districts too much, this new funding
formula.
Well,
it does on the face of it. Not too much. I mean, that's the question. Is it too much? But it gives them a lot more.
It does give them a lot more. But, okay, now let's look at this the other from the other side, too. For example, you take the Olentangy School District in Delaware County. That is one of the wealthiest areas of the state, okay? Right. But they get less than $600 per pupil. Okay, from the state and funding. And the private schools, the private charter schools, are getting like $1,500, $1,600 per pupil from the state.
From what I understand, Olentangy schools aren't suffering. Those kids go to palaces every day.
I don't know.
They have paper shortages there? I mean, what's the problem?
You know, if you would ask them, here's the problem. Here's the problem. It's a donor. The voters up there, they're donors, basically, because they're shelling out their money and their real estate taxes, a lot of money, and they don't get to keep much of it there.
In the district,
do have problems with money, because here's the issue with Olentangy. It is, if not the fastest growing in the state, it is one of the fastest. They are constantly adding students. And because of the way this formula works, they actually lose money on that. And a lot of these areas up there it's a growing district. I mean, go up to Olentangy and look at that land up there. It's open land, and they're just plopping in a subdivision here, a subdivision there. Yeah. I mean, you can start in August with one set of students, one number of students, and it's vastly different by the time May rolls around. And the state's not doing anything to compensate for that. So they do lose money, and they have to be judicious with the money they have. And yes, you know, they have school buildings that look like they're in good shape, but they are making some tough decisions.
But, you know, Olentangy is a very specific case in a way. You've got other school districts, Shaker Heights, which has been pretty up in the Cleveland area, you know, Cleveland suburb of Shaker Heights, been entrenched for years. Bayville. I mean, there's just all kinds of wealthy districts that are very entrenched now. They're not growing. They're not moving. And they're still getting a lot more.
Well, they would
deal.
under this deal.
Proposal, so.
They would under this deal. I think the thing is, though, that, the governor has proposed all these wraparound services for school districts, particularly for the lower end schools that have issues. It would provide money for the things that students need, like the counseling services, the extra assistance, you know, with school, with home kind of things. Those kind of wraparound services are important in these lower income school districts. And they are giving money. The legislature, the lawmakers are giving money to that and helping with that. That is another way and that's not in the formula. You know, that's not a formula thing.
Right.
So, I mean, there is like...
It's compensating yourself.
Yeah, it is compensating. We have the Supreme Court says we have an over-reliance on property tax. That is the ruling that has come down four times from the Supreme Court, and they have not fixed it. And how they're going to fix it, who knows? If they're ever going to fix it, who knows?
And the other thing is that, the problem is very complex, and there's different layers to the problem, whether you're in a urban, rural, or suburban district, if you're a high-growth district, if you're a low-growth district, if you have lots of, high-priced property in your area. And Ohio has, 610 different school districts?
Right.
So it is very difficult to come up with something that addresses all those different constituencies.
You have to have a one-size-fits-all plan, and it's really hard to do that.
But I think, the other thing is you've got all these private charters and stuff. And I mean, they're drawing from everywhere. I mean, so, those kids could be coming from an Olentangy as much as they could be from a Columbus City school. So, when you look at some of these school districts that are getting a very low amount of money from the state, and then the private charters getting a very high amount of money for that same student, that's
bad optics.
Issue.
But generally, charters are actually public schools, but
technically,
technically, yeah.
Right. Privately run, publicly funded,
right? And some are online. A lot of them are.
Some are for profit,
but there
still
are some
non-profit.
Private charters right. too.
Yeah. You know, let's. We have a few minutes left. Let's talk about Governor Mike DeWine. He reached his 100 days, this magical moment when fairy dust floats down from the skies and everyone sits back and ponders.
Yeah.
Yay, nay.
Yeah.
Effective, ineffective, interesting, boring.
Very different.
Very different from his predecessor. Yes.
So he is very high profile. He pops up everywhere across the state. Mm-hmm. Super active.
It hasn't been on national TV that much, though.
I don't think that's his goal.
Unlike
his predecessor.
Very state.
His cabinet is extremely diverse. It's like half women, lots of African Americans.
Democrats.
Here or there, so that's interesting. You know, he is really fond of you know, appointing task force or committees to look at this or that. So we've seen some of that activity. Mm-hmm. I think that he's keeping a pretty open mind in terms of how he's working with the legislature. I think he's much more involved, and he's making a lot of phone calls to lawmakers to kind of you know, push his agenda. He's just far more hands-on than John Kasich had been in the final.
And this is a legislature that likes that.
Well, they like – it depends what he's proposing. I mean, they've gone along with so far, at least, with a lot of his more money for children's services. But things like the gas tax, they'll give him some of what he wants. I mean, right now I think Governor DeWine's – if he's not your father's Republican, he's your grandfather's Republican. He's a Tea Party Republican, where he's not necessarily opposed to government spending if it's for the right kind of government spending.
You know, and he's sort of in the honeymoon period, and you know, with his first budget, that's when the governor really has the most power, is to you know, push the biggest policy agendas. So I think that's why we're seeing him make moves on things like more things for children. Families who are struggling, education, wraparound
services.
It's
very different from John Kasich. If you remember when Kasich took office, the very first part of his time in office, we saw Senate Bill 5, which is the anti-union measure. We saw a lot of just kind of almost inflammatory discussion from Kasich. You know, I'm going to run you over with the bus. He's called, that stuff. All that stuff came out, you know, in his first term early on. And you look at DeWine, and DeWine is more like, hey, we're going to work together. We're going to make sure that, you know, these kids that need homes are taken care of. We're going to make sure that, you know, kids are properly educated and their health is taken care of. It's like it's a totally different. I don't know. I think it's totally different vibe.
I'm wondering how much. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but signing into law one of the country's most sweeping bans on abortion, something that, you know, Kasich wouldn't even do. And he signed, something like 25 or 26 bills limiting access to abortion during his tenure. The heartbeat bill is now part of law in Ohio.
Although the ACLU is planning on...
Yeah.
Suing.
It had a
90-day clock, so it hasn't taken effect yet. And I think in order to block it, they have to sue before it takes effect. So that could be coming soon.
Yeah.
I do think that.
But it's
that,
off the table as far as the governor and the legislature is concerned.
Right.
Well,
I mean,
they don't have that hanging over. I mean, I wonder how much leverage he gained, how much, how much that helped him working with the legislature, just getting that out of the way.
Oh, I think it got it out of the way for him. But, you know, the thing is that other states have had heartbeat bills that have been put on hold by courts. So, it was kind of set up, and even going through the legislature when that bill went through, a lot of people were talking about, we want to take it to the courts. We want to take this up to the Supreme Court because we think the Supreme Court's going to say it's okay. So it was more set up for a court battle than it actually was. I think there were a lot of people who said, you know, we don't think this is going to go into effect. And they knew going into it that they were going to have a court suit on it.
To what Joe said earlier, I think the difference between Governor DeWine and Governor Kasich is Governor Kasich came in on its way up and he still has a, you know, a political career, or at least was open to it when he came in. And Governor DeWine's, he's kind of made clear that this is going to be his last job in a long career of public service. And he's thinking legacy. He's thinking, what can I get done? What do I want to get done, just not only for people today, but for Ohioans, like down the line, next generations later?
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you guys for being with us. Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thanks for your time.
Always fun.
And Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well.
Great to be here.
And Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, thanks to you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks. Go Jackets.
Go Jackets. Thanks for listening, everybody else. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Oh, my God.